From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The world waited with bated breath on Wednesday for the release, scheduled for Thursday morning, of the infamous Mueller report by the U.S. Attorney General William Barr. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero, political scientist from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, via Skype Wednesday. Well, Professor Montero, Thursday, the big day, the Mueller report being released. We're speaking on Wednesday before, so we're going to speak speculatively, but...
There is a lot of anticipation that is being built up by the corporate media. And of course, the majority of people who are going to vote in the 2020 election could care less about the Mueller report. They pretty much know all they need to know at this point, that there was no Russian collusion and that there was no attempt to subvert justice. So they want to move on. And of course, the electorate is moving on. But, you know, the Democrats thought that they would have a double hit on Trump, one with the winning back of the House in 2018. And then they were hoping that the Mueller commission would show some type of collusion and subversion of justice. And none of that. They took back the House, but the other shoe didn't fall the way they wanted it
to. Right.
So it was a big setback for them. So now they've moved to a smearing Barr and claiming that they want to see the unredacted report, which would be a really unusual thing, and a whole number of other things. And, you know, people like Jerry Nadler are pushing this, and Adam Schiff, of course, are pushing this very hard because they're in the vanguard of those in the House of Representatives who want to impeach Trump. And of course, this is dividing the Democrats in the House. One wonders how much power Nancy Pelosi has over this group of how would you call them, egotists and narcissists, who are more interested in getting on television than pursuing a common agenda. I just end by saying this. If the Democrats continue this way, there's no way in the world they will defeat Trump in 2020.
Yeah. I mean, it seems that they're playing the same game that you know, that lost the election in 2016. I'm looking at, you know, you have all these weird pressures. There, you know, there, whatever was the momentum from coming out with the Russia narrative during the election, and then, you know, beating up on that whole thing through the 2018 election, and even, you know, trying to carry it as far as they can towards 2020. There are also people that are actually interested in forcing the issue of impeachment. You mentioned, you know, what's happening on the floor, but you got like Tom Steyer, for example.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this billionaire guy who's, you know, still running TV ads, pressuring, you know, I assume contributing and leveraging contributions to political campaigns to force that issue in the House of Representatives. And I'm looking at the context being Barr saying, you know, we are now going to investigate whether or not there was a legal conspiracy to force the president from office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and investigating that as you know, criminal activity. And and in plain view, you have a billionaire who's advertising to do exactly that, to, you know, mm-hmm. almost to pressure the Congress to do it in plain view.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I guess to make sense of an absurd situation is difficult, But I guess we can kind of say that this is all a manifestation of the depth of the political crisis that we're facing. And I'd like to say what I mean by political crisis. I mean it in the sense of a crisis of governance and rule, which then makes it, in many respects, a crisis of the state. Here you have what we're being told is the best economy that we've had in 50 years. Yeah. You know, now if you're rich, if you're part of the upper, the top 20% of the population, maybe it is. Yeah, nope. But the fact of the matter is, people are less secure, have less benefits, including health care, than probably in 40 or 50 years. I mean, you don't have unions. Most people are working below the minimum wage or at the minimum wage and are working multiple jobs. This is not a good time, which means then that there's pressure from below for real political change, change in the way that the country is governed, which means, I think, the potentiality and possibility for radical political movements, not what we see of the so-called democratic socialists or social democrats in the House of Representatives, and that type of performance. But we're talking about genuine grassroots movements, beginning with the working class. And if you're talking about the working class, you're talking about certain parts of large cities that are working class communities. You're talking about working class suburbs. You're talking about places like Akron and Columbus and Flint and Detroit and the south and west sides of Detroit. You're talking about Birmingham, Alabama.
Gary, Indiana.
Yeah, these are places that there are no, quote, democratic socialists or really radical movements, but people are concluding on their own that the political system is broken.
Right.
You know, and so most times, and we can get to this also, most times people are voting protest against something than for something. And, well, that's where we are.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, they tell you that it's exactly under these conditions that ideology is so important and mm-hmm. useful a tool mm-hmm. that having a clear ideological view is so important. And mm-hmm. I'm looking at, okay, but what is that clear ideological view? The terminology even has changed because of the nature of society has changed so much since the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the working class compared to the industrial proletariat that existed mm-hmm. in 1848 or what, or, mm-hmm. Whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look around the landscape now, how do you characterize the workers, say, in Cleveland, that they're unemployed industrial proletariat, but you mm-hmm. have unemployed, information technology workers, for example, mm-hmm. in the Bay Area or in Massachusetts or wherever. And the whole working you have unemployed agricultural workers. You have all kinds of people displaced from mm-hmm. that formerly had middle class, like little petty bourgeois businesses mm-hmm. that have been replaced by computers 20 years ago. What is the class, like, they have 1%, 99% now, and it was, mm-hmm. There's the terminology that Marxists have used for a very long time. How does all that fit on the stuff that's on the ground?
Those are the big questions. And the very fact that we're asking the question of what does the working class look like in 2019 is significant, because it's not being asked. You can be a socialist and anti-working class. You can be a socialist and be for war. I would say, now this is just the way I look at it. I would say that to understand the working class in its complexities and multiple complexions, you have to begin with the black worker. The black worker still remains the most stable, the most clearly defined part of the working class. And when you look at black workers, what is characteristic of the black working class? First of all, they are poor. So being poor and being a worker are not exclusive terms. In fact, they are, in fact,
synonymous.
Yes, synonymous. To be a worker is to be poor,
right.
to make wages that do not allow you to do very much but go back to work the next day. And so the black working class is defined by its location, its spatial location, because the black working class is highly segregated. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we and then we could talk about the life world of the black worker, her life in her community, in her church, in her civic organization, in her community organization, or PTA, or whatever. The black working class anchors the working class in general. And if you begin with the black worker, you can better understand what is the working class in general. Now, you have, as you mentioned, that part of the professional worker or professional petty bourgeoisie who, because of the rise of the Bezos and the billionaire class and trillionaire corporations, the petty bourgeoisie is being pushed into the working class. However, they are new entrants into it and are less conscious of their status in society as workers. But then you get in these working class suburbs or places like Cleveland or the suburbs of Cleveland or the suburbs of Detroit, where you had these auto plants and steel plants. Well, what you see is something very similar among that part of the white industrial working class that is very similar to black workers.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They're spatially identified in crumbling, deindustrialized suburbs and cities.
It's like a white Camden.
That's right, a white Camden.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So there is a working class. It is poor. It is working more than one job, usually two or three jobs, at below the minimum wage. And they are conscious, more conscious than the middle class, the upper middle class and petty bourgeoisie, that they have no future under the existing economic and political systems.
Yeah, they have the benefit of being familiar with the geography.
That's right.
Know?
That's right.
They
That's
live there.
Right.
You know, these others just, they think they're just visiting. That hasn't settled in yet that they got dumped off there, and it's where they live now, too.
Yeah, right, right. And, you know, the real deal is that it was, they can call them right-wing populists all they want.
Right.
But it was the working class that elected Trump for the most part. Certainly that gave him the Republican nomination. It was the working class that really put Bernie Sanders in the position that he was put in 2016. And then, of course, he betrayed them, which is a problem for him in 2020. But the working class is rumbling. It is making noise. It is making its voice heard. And it's very disturbing to the elites, the traditional political class, because something drastic is going to happen in the not too distant future. And probably 2020 could be a kickoff of a new political struggle, unlike anything that we have seen in this country in ever, perhaps, you know.
Yep. And there's some interesting stuff. There's that study that you had sent out, I guess reposted on Facebook yesterday,
mm-hmm.
from 2017, that from Brian Schaffner had done a study of data involving 50,000 voters, which is a lot. That's a huge sample. 12% of Bernie Sanders supporters in the Democratic primaries, in other words, that's pretty close to 12% of Democrats that supported Bernie Sanders voted for Trump in the general election. And the numbers like this, in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania gave Trump the election. In Wisconsin, according to this, 51,000 Sanders Democratic voters voted for Trump in the general election, and Trump won by 22,000 votes. So 33,000 more, you know, he would have lost by. Michigan, 47,000 Sanders voters in the Democratic primary became Trump voters, 47,000, and Trump won by 10,000. And then in Pennsylvania, 116,000 Sanders to Trump Democratic primary voters, 116,000 to 44,000 margin for Trump. So, you know, that is really, and what this study, I was trying to figure out what it was that was offending me, and now I know what it is. They were pulling out those that voted in the primaries. That does that means independents. Some of the states, I assume, in this data allow independents to vote in the primary, but a lot of them don't, like New York. You know, that means that independents, their vote is not a part of that. So depending on where they started, where the independents were at while the primaries were going on, then looking how many of those that supported Sanders ended up voting for Trump, that would tell you something useful.
Yeah, I think it's very important, those data, and it has been completely erased from the political narrative.
Right.
You and I had spoken about that. Remember, Don, we said after the election that we disagreed with the left and liberals and so-called progressives' narrative that Trump's victory was the result of out-and-out racism, and that we were now in what they call the neo-fascist moment.
Right.
We said that was BS. We pointed to those counties where majority white counties, I think over 70 of them throughout the country, that voted twice for Obama then shifted to Trump in 2016. And then you layer that with the Bernie Sanders voters, 12% of whom, and large numbers, as it turned out, in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, who switched from Sanders to Trump, were not loyal to the Democratic Party. The other thing is, if this was not an out-and-out victory for racism, the question was then, what is it? And we said then, this is the beginning of the stirrings of the working class.
Yes.
And what they were saying, in essence, is that they reject the old order. They reject the old political establishment. By Trump's winning the Republican Party nomination, rejecting all the establishment Republicans, and then beating the most powerful political machine in the country, the Clintons, with all of the money and all of the contacts and all of the media that they had.
The whole of the media.
The whole of the media. It represented something going on at the level of the working class in general, and in this instance, primarily white workers. And if you don't want to see the potentiality of white workers in this desperate time, if you don't want to see that they can act in something that we would call class-conscious action, then you don't want to talk about the working class. And so, therefore, you're left with identity politics, either racial, gender, sexuality, or whatever.
Right. Right. If you're not going to touch economics, then you can have a field day.
That's right. You can talk about everything you want to talk about.
Just leave my money
alone.
And never
really talk about anything.
That's right. Don't mess with my money. You all go do whatever you want to do over there. Thank you. Right.
Yeah.
It's you know, we saw discussed, you know, during that time, like looking at like almost a, not a timeline necessarily, but the development of this over time, from, if you want to go to the late 90s with the stuff with the WTO and all of that, and then you have along that line the Occupy movement, mm-hmm. and then Sanders. Mm-hmm. You want to look at, you know, go back to the 90s and the uprisings that took place in the cities and mm-hmm. there. I don't know how far back you want to go. You can go back to the beginning of the country on that timeline.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to there and then looking at, you know, things then, and we have finally presenting at the same time Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. At the same time that you have Sanders, at the same time that you have Trump. You see across the board a rejection of the status quo and a mobilization of the working class, you know, and wearing the clothes that they were, you know, that they wore to the party, you know, mm-hmm. wearing the ones that they were dressed in, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, standing in place where they are standing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, and I'm certain to you, it's not all that difficult to understand, you know. I mean, there have been rumblings for change for decades, you know?
Yep.
And it was the financial crisis and the recession of 2008 and the fact that the banks and corporations recovered, but the vast majority of working people and a large part of the lower middle class never recovered, hasn't recovered to this day. The growing divide between the 1% and the majority of people, between the billionaires and the majority of people. People are angry. They are angrier now than they've been since the Great Depression of the 1930s. We are on the cusp of a profound change in this country. Now, you know, a working class or a population that is not yet prepared to take power can throw the bums out, and you're in a period of limbo where there then becomes a struggle for power. That was the French Revolution, 1789. The masses rose up, threw the aristocracy out, beheaded a lot of them, and then the political struggle between various parties of the left and the right and the center.
Right.
In fact, that whole language comes
from
of
that,
left
right.
and right and center comes from the French Revolution.
From the chamber, right. From the table
that's
that
right.
they were sitting at, basically.
That's
literally.
Right. And,
yep.
and I would argue that it was the same situation with the Russian Revolution. The Revolution of 1905 was a harbinger, and then you had the February Revolution of 1917, where the Tsar was thrown out, and then the political struggle between the liberals and various left parties and centrist parties and so on, ultimately leading to the Bolsheviks in 1917 being able to form a government, which was contested for many years after that. I think the same kind of situation could occur within the United States. A great uprising that takes the old down, but is not yet, the masses are not yet ready to organize the power of the people, or what, you know, in some terms they would call, in some language you would call, the dictatorship of the masses, of the people. And so we're in that kind of moment of the possibilities of a long political dark ages, of the growing and intensification of political chaos. But nonetheless, things will never be the same. And here I agree with Stephen Bannon when he says that Trump will be considered a historic figure. It will be after Trump, things will never be the same.
You know, And it looks like he's trying to leave his own imprimatur on that too. By the way,
of course.
I think if he was a neutral actor, it would be true anyway. I mean, the ground is shifting, but he's jumping up and down while it shifts, so he's putting footprints in the mud. So
yeah,
it's I mean, we're looking at a change that you described it before as epical, I think, and I don't think that's an exaggeration of it.
Mm-hmm.
It took, if you look at Russia, you had the dress rehearsal in 1905 for the Russian
mm-hmm.
Revolution,
mm-hmm.
and you had at that time the formation of one of the first workers' committees. Or they called them Soviets. That's what, mm-hmm. for people that mm-hmm. don't know, that's what Soviet is, just a workers' committee, that ended up being the model for the development of the government 12 years later. And
mm-hmm.
and where they set up these workers' councils everywhere. And then they used these to stitched together a government after the November Revolution, the October Revolution mm-hmm. in November of 1917.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the Occupy movement that way, you know, wondering, mm-hmm. you know, are we looking at 1905?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, are we now in some interregnum, you know, between that and,
right.
you know, I don't know.
Right. 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 Well, it is. I think so. I think you could look at it that way. You know, Occupy left its imprint upon the political consciousness of the masses of this country. And, you know, political discourse has not been the same since then. I mean, we're all talking about the 1% and the 99%.
Right.
I mean, that language in itself is significant in yeah. that it points to the 1% as the problem.
Right. It's a class critique.
I think it is. I think it is. The other thing is that, you know, we have to look at the international situation. Never before, I mean, during the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, has the international situation been so favorable for the forces fighting for peace and democracy and
yeah,
progress.
That's right.
The rise of China, but the China, right. Right. The rise of Asia, which includes Russia and yep. the Koreas and India, and all of that, is very important, because not just that these are economies that are growing at a rapid rate, but if you just take the weight of the populations, in other words, half of the world
right.
lives between China and India and the rest of Asia. That's half of the world's population.
Yep.
So the weight of that in itself can tip the scales towards progress. The West, and by which I mean the capitalist world, has never faced a more unfavorable international situation as it faces today. This at a time when there are rumblings among the masses throughout all of the major capitalist countries. So when you factor all of this in, we are in a, I won't call it a revolutionary situation, but a situation that could lead to profound and radical democratic change within the West as a whole, but the United States in particular.
And in that context, going into the election next year, for example, since so much foreign policy passes through the White House and the executive branch, mm-hmm. the question of war and peace...
Yes.
Certainly the central class question around the world, because we're
That's
talking
right.
basically about what does imperialism get to live or not, and it needs to mm-hmm. it needs to go to war to continue. We got to stop here. We're out of time.
Yeah.
Tony, we'll speak with you again next week and pick this up where we left off.
Thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.